You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New Yorker contributor Isle Press, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Also on the program today, Joe Biden, expected to sign a recently House passed 2-month debt ceiling hike. Meanwhile, mansion, cinema. Sanders and Jayapal say it's expanded Medicare coverage or bust. No quarter sandwiches this time around. U.S. opens its land borders with Canada and Mexico for the fully vaccinated. It's the first time non-essential travel by land can happen at those borders in 19 months. Meanwhile, vaccine mandate wars heat up across the country as Republicans running on a pro-COVID ticket. House Budget Chair John Yarmuth announces his plans to retire. And Biden ends workplace ICE raids, policy adopted by Donald Trump. Meanwhile, labor news, Dollar General workers looking to unionize. Yahtzee's 60,000 members. They voted to authorize a strike the other day. They continue negotiations. God bless you.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, Milwaukee sees a day without Latinx and immigrant workers. 24,000 Kaiser Permanente workers on the West Coast authorize a strike. More strikes continuing. 150 group home workers go on strike in Connecticut. That according to the Payday Report. Check that out. And more than four times the number of police officers have died of COVID than gunfire in the past year and a half. Yet those police unions still fighting a vaccine mandate. All this and more on today's program. I want you just to think about that number. Four times the number of police officers around the country have died of COVID. It's probably an undercount. Than of gunfire. And just contemplate the response by the police unions to these vaccines and to masking and whatnot, as opposed to what we would be hearing if the number of police officers killed in the past 19 months and in the wake of the George Floyd protests last year, if the number of police officers killed by gunfire had gone up four times, you can only imagine.
Yeah, many of these cities and municipalities are already quietly going back to initial levels of police funding that was reported a few days ago, and they are using these crime statistics in order to justify it. So we already see they're immediately taking reactive action based on, you know, these nebulous crime statistics.
Right. And we should also say that, you know, there is not a rise in major in violent crimes, just in murder. And so there's something specific going on, and it has happened around the country in places, red, blue states, red, blue cities, cities that have changed their policing. Very much of them have not cut their policing at all. But it's trumpeted by the police unions because this is what they do.
And hello to you.
And I should say hello to Emma Vigeland.
Yes, and I think you forgot something. Happy hump day.
That's right. It is Wednesday. I forgot about that. That's true. We started the morning off by watching a video. It's, I guess it came out in April. New Yorker magazine had a video of Wayne LaPierre shooting an elephant. Because apparently this is a sport. It's like literally shooting at the side of a barn. And then apparently not only did he not kill the elephant with the first shot, he then was brought over by a guide to shoot the elephant from literally 10 feet away.
Oh, good shot, sir.
And it took him three or four shots to do that. This is the, we may play it. I just saw it for the first time. It is so disgusting, so demented, so twisted. I mean, I don't want to get too into it, but I understand, like, people going hunting for deer. I understand it from a... I'm capable of understanding it from a sportsman perspective. And certainly I know people who eat, who kill a deer, and that becomes one of their main sources of meat for the year. But to watch this, I don't even know how you describe it. Like, you know, mini putt-putt is more of a sport than shooting an elephant. Honestly, like I don't even have an analogy.
Well, it's like downstream of Henry VIII being taken to game sanctuary in like a big coach and then shooting one out of the coach window or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
I mean, it's like literally, like we had to drive all the way to the zoo for this hunt and then just shoot the animal in the cage is basically what's going on there. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah, I don't know. Can we talk? If we talk about that in the first hour, I might swear. Not be able to help it.
Well, we'll wait on that. But people should look it up if we don't get to it. Meanwhile, we heard for days the horror that Kristen Sinema was subjected to when someone walked in behind her in a bathroom, and as she was in a stall, read off a statement about what was happening to immigrant families. And in the horror.
What she's directly causing and preventing from happening because they were her constituents. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the horror of sitting in your seat in an airline, on an airline, and having someone come up and politely ask you if you will make a commitment to not deport her family.
Yes, they interrupted her game of Fruit Ninja.
So polite, in fact, that a stewardess came by and said, is there anything else I can help you with? Are you okay? Can I get you something else? Do you
Sounds
need
like
peanuts?
A war zone.
Here is Brevard County, Florida school board member Jennifer Jacobs at a meeting in at the Brevard County school board meeting. And apparently, like she had been quiet about some of this harassment that she'd been getting, because I think maybe they've been talking about like having to wear masks in school, and she'd been holding back apparently. But I guess something came up that sort of forced her hand to reveal what's been going on with her now. And let's be clear, this is not just happening to her. Although I have no doubt the fact that she's a woman on this board adds to the level of intensity, and the fact that it's in Florida, because there's, you know, you got Ron DeSantis there running his political shop on the decidedly pro-COVID platform. But make no mistake, there's probably a dozen, if not dozens, of Jennifer Jacobs around the country dealing with this stuff. Listen to what she's been going through as a member of the school board.
And lead by example, but I probably would have appreciated that acknowledgement 6 months ago when I started dealing with this stuff, because in spite of what people believe, I am not opposed to people practicing their First Amendment rights, even when it's outside of my home on a public property. I'm not. I think it's a silly method. I think it's ineffective. It doesn't move me or motivate me in any way, but I'm not opposed to it. What I reject is this effort to create fear and division in the community that leads to credible threats of violence against me and my family. And there's a lot of things that I haven't shared with all of you up here. I've tried not to talk about this stuff publicly. And when you guys brought this up today in the workshop, I felt off guard and frustrated, because then it became something on our agenda that I couldn't express to you why I was against it any longer, because now it has to be in the sunshine. I don't reject people coming here and speaking their voice. They do it all the time. We don't stop them from doing that. I don't reject them standing outside my home. I reject them following me around in a car, following my car around. I reject them saying that they're coming for me, that I need to beg for mercy. I reject that when they are using their First Amendment rights on public property, they're also going behind my home and brandishing their weapons to my neighbors. That they're making false DCF claims against me to my daughter, that I have to take a DCF investigator to her playdate to go underneath her clothing and check for burn marks. That's what I'm against, which is a credible threat and calculated.
So that's what she's referring to there is Department of Child Welfare. Essentially, or the equivalent down in where she lives. And I should say her, I said her name was Jennifer Jacobs. I meant Jenkins. And I mean, that's actual harassment. That is not, and you can see clips of like protesters outside her house at night and this and that. And occasionally that will happen. I can certainly, as a general rule, you know, I think that people who are in the public eye, that happens. In my mind, I prefer it for people who are trying to avoid dealing with certain things, like who are shrouded, you know, maybe the CEO of a gun manufacturer or something to that effect. But
the public eye.
But she is a school board
member. Yeah, right.
And everything else she accounted. I mean, these people should be arrested. As far as I'm concerned, here is Josh Hawley from Missouri complaining to a DOJ official who put out a notice that if state law enforcement needs to deal with situations like this, like people essentially like, you know, swatting school board members. By calling child services.
They're concerned about child abuse, by the way, this crowd, this anti-mask crowd. Concerned about child abuse.
Which Tucker Carlson told them to be.
Yeah.
And right. Here's Josh Hawley complaining that the DOJ is offering federal help in the event that there's been any law breaking in this instance. Here's Josh Hawley, and this is, I should say, video from the recount, which stitches together both Hawley's words and some of these situations around the country.
Is waiting to express one's view at a school board meeting, harassment and intimidation?
We know who you are.
We
find you, and we know
who
you are.
You will never be allowed in public
again. You better watch out.
Harassment and intimidation? What did those terms mean in the context of a local school board meeting?
I will come after you.
I'm going to come for everybody.
You have awakened the ape army, and we will come for you, and the Holy Spirit is coming with us.
If this isn't a deliberate attempt to chill parents from showing up at school board meetings, I don't know what is.
You need to be arrested!
You're allowing child abuse. You're allowing child abuse.
It's child abuse!
Tell me where the line is with parents expressing their concerns.
Multiple people were arrested, including one man who was tackled to the ground by deputies.
Fists are now flying. All of this on live television.
Hey. Whoa, guys, come on. Hey, officers.
Whatever happened to just working things out?
Yeah.
You got to call the FBI.
I mean, there it is. You know, this is, it is, I mean, this is some real psycho stuff.
They're deliberately downplaying it because this is a part of a grassroots, we're now learning, astroturf campaign funded by people like the Koch brothers who are trying to gin up and excite this kind of anger because they see it as a political tool. And these people screaming child abuse, as Matt said, that was planted in their minds by Tucker Carlson and then all of the other right-wing pundits that copy him. As they're basically swatting this school board member who we played before, Jenkins, and having her child search for burn marks. If you don't think that's traumatic to the child and you really care about child abuse, maybe all of this is just a projection of your anger about society slipping away from you and you've got, you're a subject of a like Republican campaign to exploit your anxiety. There's no introspection about it, and it's all projection about their children. They pretend it's about their children when in reality it's about themselves.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. When we come back, we'll be talking to New Yorker contributor Eyal Press, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. I've told this story years ago. I was on an airline flight, and I sat next to some dude who had these, you know, like was starting to tell me about a product he was pitching. I don't think it ever went anywhere, but he was like, do you know that mouthwash is full of alcohol? And I'm like, no, I did not know that. And he goes, that's why, like, the guy down the, you know, this was 20 years ago, the guy down the hall, he has that mouthwash in his drawer. I guess he assumed I actually had a job. And he said, the guy down the hall, he's got the mouthwash in the drawer, and that's why.
He's gotta drink it. According to cinema standards, that's harassment to be spoken to on a plane.
Exactly.
Right.
It actually did feel like harassment.
Should have pressed charges.
It turns out mouthwash has not changed in almost 140 years. You go into the supermarket or you go into the pharmacy or wherever you go, most brands are still selling those huge bottles that are mostly full of water and alcohol. And that's why the oral care experts at Quip have created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need, and it comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that's 100% recyclable. You guys know Quip is the makers of the electric toothbrush and the floss that I talk about almost relentlessly. Quip mouthwash kills bad breath germs. It helps prevent cavities, leaves you feeling fresh. And this is all because of a formula that gives your mouth everything it needs. They're four times concentrated, has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the stinging alcohol, which is also just not good for you. You find in a lot of other rinses. You can get a customizable subscription, so you get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles made from 100% recyclable plastic. And mouthwash is, of course, the perfect finishing touch to the complete oral care routine. You pair it with the Quip electric toothbrush, both for parents and adults, or adults, I guess, and kids, I should say. I'm just thinking about my household. My kids have their Quips. Milo has the full-size bristle. Saul has the little one. Refillable flossers, which I think are one of the greatest inventions I have ever seen that they make. And their grape-tasting good-for-you gum that comes in one of those like little Pez dispensers. You've heard me talk about Quip many times. They're an amazing, in my mind, design company that have basically focused their design on the idea of helping you develop a habit to have good oral hygiene. And it has certainly worked in my family. The toothbrush, super easy, not one of those big bulky ones. You travel with it, you take it with you. It is almost the size of a regular toothbrush. The refillable flosser, honestly, I feel like I could do an hour-long program about it. But if you go to getquip.com/majority5 right now, you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. It's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. It includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-dose supply of Quip's four-time concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. Spelled getquip.com/majority5. Quip, the good habits company. Also, this is a... one of our sponsors today, listener of the program, who has been a who's a longtime listener, who has had years of experience of working in the solar industry. Some of the places he was working for, he found that some of their practices were a little bit predatory insofar as getting people into leases that weren't necessarily in their best interests. Many people who own homes have been, started to contemplate solar, but you don't know where to start. There's a lot of homeowners who aren't aware that solar options are currently available for them, both in terms of turning back their meters and as backup energy. It's now possible to retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. This is possible thanks to the Solar Investor Tax Credit, which is going to go away soon. My Solar Nerd's mission, mysolarnerd.com, their mission is simple. They help you find the best solar program for your house and make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. And what they do is they analyze your usage, they find the best equipment for your needs, they determine the incentives and financing you may be qualified for, and then they project manage the process between you and the installers. They obtain the permits, they decide, you know, what's the best angle, where's the best place for this, et cetera, et cetera. Don't want to wait on this. Some of those tax credits and incentives are sunsetting. The current 26% tax credit drops down to 22% next year before going away. If a project's completed by the end of this year on 12/31, that homeowner qualifies for the 26% ITC. So there's still time. And like I say, some markets that are prone to power outages may qualify for off-the-grid backup solutions. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. Go to mysolarnerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select the Majority Report listener for how you heard about My Solar Nerd at mysolarnerd.com. And that way, when you get in the installation, you get a $200 gift card. Check it out, mysolarnerd.com. All right, want to welcome to the program, or I should say back to the program, I believe, IL Press. He is the author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Ayal, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh.
We cannot hear you. Let's make sure that your microphone is on. All right, why don't we take just a quick break while you work on that?
Oh, yeah,
we can hear you now.
Sorry about that. It was the microphone. Thank you so much for having me on, and apologies for that.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Thanks for being here. All right, let's start with Everett Hughes. Who is Everett Hughes? Why is he relevant?
So he's kind of a forgotten man in the discipline of sociology, but he was a sociologist at the University of Chicago, and he wrote this essay in 1962 called Good People and Dirty Work. And that is actually the starting point, the point of departure for the book I just wrote. Hughes wrote that essay after spending a semester teaching abroad in post-war Germany. And he went there, and the folks he talked to were the people he'd known before the war, kind of intellectuals, you know, architects, teachers. And he goes there and he wants to know, you know, what are they going to say about the great, you know, atrocities that just occurred under the Nazis? And, you know, what he's expecting to hear is indeed partly what he hears, which is these folks tell him, you know, we had no choice when the Nazis were in power. And we're, of course, we're ashamed of what the Nazis did. But then some of them go on to say, you know, but the Jews, they were a problem. The Jews were a problem. You know, they were they were taking all the good jobs. They were gathering in these ghettos. And we're not saying what the Nazis did was okay, but something had to be done to settle this problem. And Hughes kind of keeps hearing this. And in this essay that I mentioned, Good People and Dirty Work, the good people are obviously the folks he knew. The dirty work is what the Nazis did. And what Hughes basically posits is that we cannot look at the Nazis as rogue actors who were just kind of acting on their own. We have to see them as agents of the good people, not because the good people actually approved of what they were doing, but because they just pushed it out of their minds, right? They didn't want to think about it. They wanted someone else to handle it for them. And that idea, what's so interesting about it to me is if you think about other countries, the contemporary United States, for example, and you think about morally questionable things that go on here, you can see a very similar dynamic playing out. And actually, Hughes says this in the essay, right? He's an American, and he says, look, I'm not writing this to indict the German people. I'm writing this to warn my fellow Americans against the dangers in our own midst. And so I decided to take that idea and kind of update it and look at, you know, how much of this kind of this, what he calls dirty work, goes on here, and how much do the rest of us sort of tacitly mandate it? Hughes called it an unconscious mandate. So that's really the idea of the book.
So what you're saying is you didn't take it from Steely Dan, which was my initial thought when I read the book title.
I have been asked that. It's a great song, but no, it's not about it's not about my book. No relationship.
It's now stuck in my head, but
you want to promote my book by all means, you know.
All right. Well, but let me. So one of the things that strikes me about Hughes's work is that. And we'll go through the really the four areas in which you sort of look at this stuff. But there's also that argument has been, I think, in some circles been made pretty, distinctly in the context of policing in this country. That on some level, I mean, to the extent that there's a view of police, at least, you know, and I think Chris Hayes had a book about this, Colony in a Nation, that this concept of policing for a significant number of people in this country is really about control as opposed to, you know, help serve and protect. And that this is what we hire the police to do. To essentially control portions of our society, you know, the people who are living in poverty, people who are have marginal political power, people of color, black people, that there is sort of this like unconscious mandate for them to offer that control. So let's start with, I think, you know, we see this. That is closest, I think, to what you look into, like correctional facilities and an array. And we should say you look at correctional facilities, slaughterhouses or meat processing, broadly speaking, our drone program and
oil rigging
and oil rigs and as different areas. So, I mean, let's just talk a little bit just more about the mandate, because the mandate obviously is pretty obvious there for correctional facilities. We need to house a lot of people. I mean, we don't need to, but in my opinion. But I mean, talk about we can stop with Harriet Krasowski.
Yeah. Yes.
Her story is just devastating.
Yeah. So let's start with the criminal justice system. You mentioned police, and I should say that, you know, the reason I didn't specifically look at police officers is because the dirty work in my book is done by people who get stigmatized by a pretty broad swath of society for what they're doing. And that's true of part of the population when it comes to police officers. But there's another part of the population that doesn't see the work they do, which you mentioned, which you described as control. They see it as not just okay, but heroic, right? And so I didn't want to choose an example where there's such a split. And when we shift from police officers to corrections officers or to people who work in the prison system, there I think there's much more of a kind of general, yeah, right. The turnkeys, you know, the folks who are watching over this incarcerated population, which is, of course, the largest incarcerated population in the world. I definitely think that, you know, the policing you mentioned that is troubling has a kind of unconscious mandate, a popular mandate. It's not total, obviously. People are protesting it. But it is also not the work of rogue actors, right? I don't see that. Similarly with prisons. And if we go to the example I start the book with, I look specifically at Harriet Krasowski because she works in the mental health ward of a prison. And prisons and jails are the largest mental health institutions in the United States, right? So that is a form of labor that could be taking place in a hospital. It could be taking place in a community service center. But we don't fund mental health, especially in poor communities, at a level that is remotely adequate to addressing the need. So what we do instead is we rely on prisons and jails effectively, as you said, to warehouse this population. And I think that dehumanizes both the incarcerated people and the people who work in those facilities.
And I'd be remiss, if I didn't note that this was a federal decision during the Reagan era to defund, which is not to say that our mental health the institutions were particularly of high quality, but they existed, and we had a distinction between people who needed services versus who are going to be criminalized. Tell the story of what happened to Harriet regarding Darren Rainey, because this is just
sure.
I think this is where you get it's a great illustration of this dynamic. And I should also say this idea that the people that you focus on are sort of the unclean or the untouchables in a certain caste system within our society. And so they get it almost two or three times over.
Yes.
In terms of
So Harriet takes this job. She's getting $12 an hour. It's post-recession Florida. She's never worked in a prison before. She goes in there and she thinks that the guards at the prison are her allies. They're the people who are going to protect her. It's an all-male prison. She's a new person. She starts hearing the folks in the mental health ward, the guys who are there, telling her, they're not giving us meals, Harriet. They're skipping my meal. And she hears this enough that she actually asks her supervisor about it. And her supervisor says, our job is not to ask those questions. Our job, effectively, I'm paraphrasing, our job is to get along with security. And Harriet then discovers that it's even worse than just skipping meals. They are locking some of the mentally ill prisoners at this facility, the Dade Correctional Institution, in a shower where the guards locked the door and they controlled both the water flow and the water temperature from the outside. And they put a guy named Darren Rainey in this shower, and he dies in this shower. And apologies for the graphic nature of it, but suffers burns on about 90% of his body. This was torture, this was murder. And it was a case that eventually came out because a prisoner there leaked it. A guy named Harold Hempstead leaked it to the Miami Herald. But let it be said, we would not know about this case if it had been left up to the staff at the prison. Because Harriet, by that point, she hears about this. She's too scared to report it. Because when she challenged the guards before, they start disappearing from the rec yard where she's doing her work, right? They basically leave her alone. They say, you challenge us, you're on your own. We run this place, you don't. And all of the mental health staffers, most of the ones I interviewed were women, who really needed the work. A number of them were women of color, working, as they said, to support their families or themselves. They had no other better alternatives. And yet there they were, trapped in this dilemma because they felt horrible about it. I mean, I talked to them years after the fact. And, in Harriet's case, she doesn't say anything about what she saw, but she falls into a depression. Her hair falls out. She really sort of experiences the feeling of complicity, of being derbied, right? And I think the point of that story is it's a very graphic illustration of something that we've set up as a society to happen over and over again, right? You have these mental health aides, not paid well, working under harsh conditions in an environment that is just about the last place you would want to put people with severe mental illnesses. And as a consequence, there's a lot of, abuse that doesn't get reported that we never hear about.
And the idea here is to show both that we are sort of like warehousing our problems in some fashion, and that people who are like on some respect are you know, working the warehouse floor are also suffering as much as the people who are being warehoused, or to some degree, I guess. I mean, the idea being that this is, it's like it's eating away at our society in some fashion.
Well, I think so. The book is fundamentally about inequality. So I show over and over again in these cases that who ends up doing this work is not society's elites, right? It's people like Harriet. It's people like those women that I interviewed that were working there. But then also the inequality extends to who is held accountable, right? Take a look at, you know, that was in Florida in 2012. The governor at the time was Rick Scott. Rick Scott didn't pay a price for what happened to Darren Rainey. Rick Scott is now a senator, right? The head of the wardens, the senior members of the Department of Corrections, they didn't pay a price. The people who get blamed, there were a couple of guards who were moved out. And by all means, they are accountable. They are responsible. But it's very reminiscent of the Abu Ghraib story, right? Where you have this scandal that takes place and the country sees these pictures of these soldiers and it's torture, but no senior officials are called to account. Instead, we hold accountable the low-ranking reservists who were there. And I think it's very similar in prisons.
And there's also, also speak to a prison guard named Bill Curtis, who brings up sort of like there's a structural element to this, too, in terms of that is not so much a couple of bad apples, but it's just sort of like the way that, at least in the context of funding the prisons and like, you know, what people want this, I guess, this unconscious mandate again. He expresses that. Retell that story.
Yeah, so Bill Curtis worked as a corrections officer in Florida, and he didn't deny that there was brutality in the system. You know, he actually shared his diary with me, and in that diary, it's really a pretty amazing document because he begins very wide-eyed and idealistic, and he says, you know, if anyone breaks the rules in this profession, they're going to be fired. And he quickly discovers that's not the case. There are these what he calls serial bullies among the guards who are you know, doing awful things and getting away with it and sometimes getting rewarded for it. But Bill Curtis does not ultimately hold them to account as much as he holds the people of Florida. He says, you know, he says to me, the citizens here get what they pay for. Florida has had at the time the third largest prison system in the United States. And it spent the second least on mental health services as a state, right? So what do you expect is going to happen here, right? You're filling the prisons and jails with this population that the guards are not trained to deal with. And even if they're well-intentioned, they're not going to do a very good job of this because it's just the structure is inhumane, right? And so what Bill Curtis said to me that really stood out, he said, you know, when a good man or a good woman works in this system, a little bit of that goodness wears off. And I think that is true. You know, it doesn't mean they're blameless, but I think we need to expand the circle of accountability.
Let's talk about the meat processing next. You talk about a woman who was working in a chicken factory, and her husband was her supervisor at one point. Yeah, talk about that dynamic and what's happening in those chicken houses that sort of follow this pattern, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So this is a plant. This is a poultry slaughterhouse in Texas, owned by Sanderson Farms, one of the biggest companies in the poultry industry. The workers at that plant, as at so many poultry plants in this country, predominantly women of color, immigrants, a number of them undocumented immigrants. And Flora Martinez, which is the pseudonym of this particular worker, she starts working there. And as you said, her husband is a supervisor, and the supervisors are just, you know, yelling at the workers to speed up, to not take breaks. It was so bad in this plant that she, Flora Martinez, and others described to me not being allowed to take bathroom breaks. So that women working on these lines were literally going to work with two pairs of pants, or with an extra pair to change into, because they would not be allowed to go to the bathroom, because the whole point is produce as much as possible, in as little amount of time. That's your job. You have to stay on point. And the result of that is both terrible physical injuries, repetitive strain injuries and injuries to different workers would point to their shoulder, their elbow. But it's even more than that. It's an assault on their dignity. If we valued these workers, these were workers who were dubbed essential workers during the pandemic. If we really thought they were essential, we would think not just about, how they're the injuries they suffer, but just the sheer inhumanity of expecting people to endure those conditions. And in fact, a lot of native-born Americans won't endure them, which is, of course, why so many immigrants and undocumented folks and refugees do work in the meatpacking industry.
It reminds me of a story from last week where Direct Action Everywhere, it was a videographer who came out and they released this footage of a slaughterhouse of a chicken processing plant, and the workers there were not abiding by animal cruelty standards, but it was because they had to work at this breakneck pace, as you mentioned, in order to meet these quotas. And as a part of the larger dynamic that you talk about here, I don't think there's anything more indicative of the compartmentalization that occurs with a lot of these industries that you cover here than chicken processing or meat processing, because it feeds into larger consumption habits that nobody in the United States, if you're not a vegetarian or vegan, doesn't want to be thinking about. And then there's also those added dynamics of this falling on workers who are either immigrants or non-white, for example.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up that video, and I'm glad that the video showed why the workers were doing that rather than just, I think sometimes in the past, some animal rights activists have kind of pointed the finger at the workers saying, how could you be doing this without actually showing what you just described, which is this is why they're doing this, right? And just to get back to Dirty Work and Everett Hughes, there are two kinds of work I look at in this book. One is work that, like prisons or drone strikes, those are government functions, right? Those are public functions. And to that extent, even if you don't support that personally, it is clearly something that has some kind of public, whether you want to call it a mandate or some imprimatur from the public that says this is going on in our name. But the other part of the book is about the dirty work that goes on in the private sector, but that consumers rely on and depend on. And in the case of poultry, we're talking about America's most popular meat, right? We're talking about a demand that, if you think of the fast food chains and all of the popularity of chicken as a healthy alternative to beef, well, this is part of the story too. This is the behind the scenes, we have scenes like that you described and stories like Flor Martinez's story.
I'm going to circle back to the concept of essential workers, and particularly in the context of COVID. But let's, since we're at that point of the demand for something and this almost sort of this conflict and this sort of obscuring, whenever I hear about a meat processing, I think of Frederick Weissman's documentary Meat, which is, relentless. And you sit through that and it's your perspective at least changes dramatically, it seems to me. But you also speak to folks who work on an oil rig. And this is a great example, too, of the disdain that people might have for somebody who works on an oil rig, because your job is basically to pull stuff out of the ground that's killing the planet on some level. But it obscures sort of these other issues. And you talk about the BP explosion in the Gulf and how the death of 10 workers was completely neglected. Talk about that dynamic, because I'm of two minds of that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are probably of two minds about that. But what you're talking about in particular came to a head at a Senate hearing on the BP spill, the Deepwater Horizon spill, which, as you say, killed a number of workers. And the workers, the family members of some of those workers were at that hearing. They were in the audience, as well as some workers who survived the blast, including a guy named Stephen Stone, who I write about, who was aroused about. And they're there. And the senators are holding up pictures of birds and wildlife that got affected by the spill. And, you know, that's appropriate on one level because this was a horrible environmental catastrophe. And the oil industry is a, you know, I would say existential threat to the environment. That's all well and good. But there were no pictures held up of the workers who had died. And this really struck not only Stephen Stone, but his then wife, Sarah, who was in the audience and goes on to kind of paint these pictures of the family members who are there, the anguish in their faces. And, you know, who ends up being aroused about on an oil rig in the Gulf? You know, I talk a little bit about that. It is a good paying job, by the way. I don't want to be, a lot of the jobs I write about don't pay well at all, or they pay just above minimum wage. But this is a good paying job. But why does someone like Stephen Stone do it? Well, his other option is to work for really low pay without benefits at the local rug factory in Alabama, where he happens to be. And he doesn't want to do that. You know, he's come out of the Navy, he's a high school graduate. And he's told, you know, hey, you can make a lot more doing this work as a roustabout. And my point is that, and I compare kind of in that section of the book, there's also an element of regional inequality, because what people in the Gulf will tell you, and it's not so easy to answer this, is, you know, you guys come down from California or the East Coast and, you know, you look at all these chemical plants and these oil rigs and, you know, this whole zone of fossil fuel production, and it looks so bad, you know, and you say, you know, this is condemnable. Well, how did you get here? Right? You flew or you drove. Who powers, you know, what does this society rely on to such an extent? And so there is a kind of doublespeak until we get more serious about, you know, shifting away from fossil fuels as a society.
It's just one more sort of, I guess, externality, too. I mean, all of these things are just externalities, right? That society gets what it wants and it dishes off the low cost or the physical or mental anguish onto other people who are, in many respects, you know, disenfranchised or politically marginalized. The last area, drone work. There's been reports over the years of what it does to people who work on drones, but this is also like a great example of like super, super unconscious mandate, but also maybe a conscious effort to make that mandate more unconscious to the American public.
No question. And here I think we also have to talk about, you know, the bipartisanship involved, because, you know, the drone program begins after 9/11 under Bush, but it gets ramped up under Obama. And then ramped up even more under Trump. And, you know, it's on the one hand, I think the whole idea of, you know, these targeted assassinations conducted from a distance by people who are sitting at computer screens, there's something creepy about that when people hear about it. There's something unsettling. On the other hand, there's something incredibly convenient as a society, because we had these expensive, failed ground wars, right? And everybody kind of was sick of that across the political spectrum. And we had Guantanamo and the sort of whole moral question of, you know, if these, you know, suspects are captured, where are they detained and what will the conditions be? Well, a large part of the answer to that ended up being, unfortunately, we're not going to detain them. We are going to, you know, hit them with a Hellfire missile.
Kill them.
Kill them with no questions asked, right? With sort of in the shadows. And what I think is sort of, you know, twists it even further is that the people who are actually in the drone program, they are the ones who actually do see the footage, right? Who actually do record and watch. And the military itself, you know, showed me studies. They are exposed to more graphic violence on average than the typical soldier on the ground. That doesn't mean they experience it in the same way, but they see it. And so what you see is high rates of burnout, high rates of stress, and high rates of what I call moral injury, which is actually what, again, what psychologists and chaplains in at the drone bases were telling me. You know, they'd have guys come up to them and say, you know, what is Jesus going to say about all the killing I've seen, all the killing I've been involved in? And I think what's especially relevant to this discussion is, you know, what matters about the killing that goes on in a war is how a soldier can conceptualize it afterwards, right? Like, okay, my unit was under fire. We fired back. It was kill or be killed, right? Or I was on a mission, you know, it had a goal. The goal had to be reached to protect my country. But what if you are sitting far away and you are not under fire, and then you see on the screen that there are civilians that have been hit, right? How do you process that? And when you don't even have a space to process it, because you're going straight from that job to a society that is sort of, oh, the wars? What wars? You know, some of these drone bases are in Nevada, right near Vegas. So it's that disconnect that I really focus on.
Let me let's get into sort of like this concept of essential workers, and this, you know, I think really was heightened during COVID. I mean, we have really and there's also sort of like you mentioned this distinction between these government jobs, one being the drone operator and one being the corrections officer in the private sector. Let's take the private sector for a moment, just separate, because on one hand, like I can see. The government jobs, you know, what I think your book does is it says, you know, people should be aware of that unconscious mandate. On the private sector, it feels like this is really what we're looking at is capitalism in many respects. I mean, isn't that what we're talking about? I mean, we talk about you can't go to the bathroom if you're working in the meat processing plant. Because we need to squeeze every bit of profit we can out of this. I mean, frankly, it's also probably the case in the corrections facility, because that's all privatized prisons to some extent, too, I would imagine. And when we talk about the oil rigs, the externalities that these capitalists pour onto the workers is exactly what they're doing also with the planet. I mean, isn't this a story of capitalism in many respects?
I would say I don't disagree with you, but I would say that it is a story of American capitalism. I don't mean to you know, put too fine a point on that, but in the slaughterhouse section of my book, I actually talk a little bit about what happened in Germany when there was a COVID outbreak there, and the company that owned the plant tried to blame the workers, which is what happened here too, by the way. Oh, it's their lifestyle. They don't, you know, they all live together. They're, you know, they're not being careful. The German equivalent of the labor secretary came out and said, no, you're not getting away with that. This whole industry, he called it a system of organized irresponsibility, and called for fundamental change, and actually changes were passed. Well, here, with Trump in office, we had a very different response from the government. The government went along with the blaming the workers rather than the companies. And actually, Trump invoked the Defense Production Act to mandate that workers go back to work in meatpacking plants, even when there were no basic safety measures there. Why? Because there was supposedly a meat shortage in this country. As I describe in the book, at the same time that the industry was claiming that, they were shipping record amounts of pork to China, right? There was no shortage. This was political power being exercised to, I would say, in support of American capitalism, deregulated, you know, what the companies with the money and the lobbyists say goes, basically. So that would be my only, you know, sort of twist on that formulation, but definitely it's absolutely about, you know, our economic system.
I mean, and we see that, but even if we broaden out and we talk about the essential workers, I mean, I'm curious, was essential workers in the subtitle before COVID? And when you wrote this, because it, I mean, I think COVID really did sort of bring that to the fore. And it is, I'm not convinced. I think in this instance, there are certainly excesses that you can be attributed to Trump. But I mean, let's face it, all of these dynamics are going to exist, existed before Trump, and they're going to exist after Trump. And it is a system that is simply just set up that way where, it's not just these the public mandates. There's also this sort of like, you know, capital is going to exploit as much as it can at that point.
Absolutely. It was not in the subtitle before the pandemic. You know, I'll readily admit what was very much in my mind, and it was really fascinating to watch. I've been thinking the whole, you know, as I was writing this book, just about the division of labor. But what I was thinking about was the moral division of labor. You know, who does the dirty work and who doesn't? The epigraph in my book is from James Baldwin. And Baldwin, of course, put it as eloquently, more eloquently than I. You know, the powerless must do their own dirty work. The powerful have it done for them. And he wasn't referring to Everett Hughes, but that point is actually what I try to show in the book, and the moral costs of that, right? We know about inequality causing, you know, just the division, the disparities in terms of wealth and income. We don't think as much, and I don't think we think enough about the division when it comes to stigma and moral injury and degradation, you know, just the sense that these moral and emotional and psychic burdens are borne by some and not others.
That is, I think you cite, is it Cobb and Sennett on these hidden injuries of class? Just talk about that concept a little bit, because I also wonder if there isn't an opportunity for an increase in class consciousness, not necessarily based on the dollars, but on the garbage that you have to deal with, essentially the mental and emotional toil that is paid. But just explain that concept of the hitting injuries of class.
Yeah. So this great classic book by Richard Sennett and Cobb, written, I think, in the early 70s, but talked about how we should be, when we think of class analysis, we can't just think of material disparities. We can't just think of dollars and cents. We also have to think about, as they put it, the moral burdens and emotional hardships that workers endure. And I think that's such a powerful idea, but it kind of fell out of the conversation, right? It really hasn't, you know, even with Occupy Wall Street and the renewed attention to inequality and Bernie Sanders and others coming forward to talk about inequality, we don't really talk about those moral burdens and emotional hardships. And they are not randomly distributed. They are not born equally in the society. I do talk about at certain points in the book, sort of white collar workers who do morally troubling things, because certainly a lot of them do, bankers and, you know, tech on you know, software engineers in the tech world, but their lives are very different than Flora Martinez's, than Harriet Krzyzkowski's. You know, one, because when you are successful and you have a lot of money, you have more choices, right? You're really troubled by what you're doing, you can leave. The second thing is that, you know, in our society, material wealth and success has a sort of sheen of moral virtue to it, right? You're not sort of out there in the shadows. So I think that my hope is that we start having a more well-rounded conversation about inequality, where things like dignity and, you know, just people's place in the community based on what they go through every day, where we talk about those things.
Isle Press, the book is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Thanks so much for your time. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
So much. Thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Be right back. Wrap things up. To our Peacock viewers, we're going to say goodbye in just a moment, but we will continue this conversation because, I mean, I've got a long list of people who are on strike or have authorized strikes. I mean, we're in the hundreds of thousands now. IATSE, Kaiser Permanente, we've got nurses in Buffalo and Worcester and in Connecticut and across the country. We're seeing workers talk about strikes. And when they're striking, it is the treatment they're getting at the workplace, which is the one that is really sticking out. Obviously, you know, there's money, but people are being overworked. And I wonder if that concept of that other aspect, the non-financial aspect of class as a proxy, is effective. But we will talk more about that. Goodbye to our Peacock viewers.
Goodbye.
All right, for the rest of you, we continue that conversation.
There's this dynamic, too, that I think I wish we were able to get to, that I think there was a reckoning and a mass understanding of the value of one's labor that we haven't seen in a while in the midst of the pandemic because work was so affected. And so I think like that's part of what's galvanizing people.
I think it's the opposite.
The inverse?
I think it's the opposite. I think the people understanding the power of their labor is downstream from them saying like, we're getting just absolutely crapped on here. And I think we started to see this with the teacher strikes too. It wasn't just about the cash. That was an issue, no doubt. But it was also about like understaffing. I mean, you hear about understaffing. The IATSE thing is very much about like, you can't make us work 14 hours a day. It's just, you know, 5 days in a row. It's just like, you can't do it. You can't make us work on an assembly line or in a factory and not let us take a leak. You know, this is not the way that human beings should be treated. I think the fact that there is you don't get money is one of the reasons why these, goes hand in hand with the way that these companies and corporations and capitalists feel that they can exploit their workers this way.
Yeah, how many times have we heard during the strikers sort of elaborating how they feel, and it's like they treat us like robots? They say it like that, like the Amazon workers, the Kellogg's workers, we're treated like robots, like we're just a cog to put in this machine, and then once we break,
yeah.
And you know, you hear about it, like people working with somebody with like a torn ligament or something in their knee, and they're hobbling all over the place, and they can't, and at a job where you're literally not allowed to sit down or lean against something. I mean, it's just, I mean, crazy.
And this is, I mean, look, there is, we have tremendous economic disparity in this country. We have a dynamic where it has been very, very difficult, it feels like, to instigate any type of class consciousness in regards to money, because our society is so built around the idea that like you could win the lottery and
fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
I mean, all of that on those financial terms. But the one thing that Americans do seem to understand is aggrievement in the way that they're treated. And that cuts across ideological grounds. You have different people feeling aggrieved for different reasons.
Yes, but that's also part of part of why the pandemic was instrumental in some of this awakening, right? There was
exactly.
That added health anxiety, which was 100% correct and understandable, that got people thinking a little bit more about treatment at work.
Exactly. It was about treatment. It was the way that the workers are treated, and distinct from the financial compensation in their minds.
Which
now,
is already.
I think ultimately, you know, that needs to be integrated. But I wonder if there isn't a means to class consciousness that has to do with, you know, the way that people are just like treated and questions of dignity and whatnot at work. All that said, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to head into what we call the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-3920 is the number. We will be taking your phone calls today. Also,
you skipped the middle three digits, but whatever.
So what is it? 646-257-3920?
Yeah, it's fine.
Oh, jeez. 646-257. Well, it's fine.
You
call
said
that
646-3920 is the number.
Good luck. Good luck with that one. 646-257-3920 is the number. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can help the show survive and thrive by becoming a member. It is your support that keeps the show alive. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Join our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. 4,000 members and growing. It is free. A great opportunity for you to exchange resources. There's opportunities for mutual aid. There's discussions on policy. There is, you know, it's an amazing resource. Check it out. Also, you can IM the show by getting the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget, on Nomi's show this week, she is in Glasgow and awaiting the UN climate summit. And there's a lot of people there who get there before the representatives from the countries. And she's interviewing all of them. All of them.
I saw she Instagrammed a photo with Al Gore.
Oh, she really?
Mm, yeah. So maybe she got him.
Deep state. And so check it out, youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. The Nomiki Show. The Nomiki Show.
Just pick one on the day
Show.
And say it with confidence. Just sell it.
I mean, I do. I sell it. I sell it both ways. So check that out. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lachian universe of media?
Tonight, Maximilian Alvarez of the Working People podcast will be talking about actually similar things to what we're talking about today, regards to COVID and labor. And also be talking about Russell Brand and his vaccine stuff, but also a really good question he asked Brett Weinstein. So check that out tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game, but subscribe to the YouTube channel.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.